This is book G, capital G, starts in 1961, and is a continuation of the work that was going on in book, the preceding book F, with splitting tests resumed. And the first page sets up the hypothesis as to what I was considering was happening at that time. Looking at it now, it wasn't very far wrong. That basically you could take the haptoglobins and reduce them to a single species, or virtually single species of molecule, with mercaptan ethanol at a high pH. But if you had urea, then you began to split them into the two chains, the constant chain and the variable chain, which we later called HP. Well, which by then we were already calling little HP1 and little HP2. So it was, the hypothesis was fairly good, and tests were continued to try to show that it was correct. In the following pages, for quite a while, tests of different pHs and so on. So that by page 5, it's talking about the results suggest a big effect of Versine or Trif on the electrophoresis, etc. And I'm still thinking about resynthesis, as I call it. The gels on page 7 of opposite page 7 are interpreted, I think, as showing that there is some resynthesis, but I think it's probably all failure to cleave properly. As on page 9, I'm talking about the results show that pH 8.2 plus mercaptan ethanol showed incomplete split, etc. Talking about how to get splitting into the still native monomers. And a higher pH test on page 11, July 26, looks from hindsight very promising. And so I'm continuing this type of work. For example, page 17 shows all of the gels there now, which are with Versine, are showing splitting into the native component. And so on and so forth. Higher pH is being tested, and higher mercaptan ethanol on longer time by the time we get to August 1st. Continuing in the same vein. Trying the effect of starch concentration on Wednesday, August 2nd. Fairly good that up to 160% is practical, although difficult. Still no resolution. And a rather obscure comment on page 29. The new buffer systems tested on page 31, glycine and phosphate. And talking about resynthesis in both phosphates, but with a caution. A lower pH is tested and continuing. And then a little intermission on Saturday, August 5th, to purify brilliant crystal blue. Lower pHs and two-dimensional gels tested in August 6th. with some thought on page 43 that resynthesis had occurred on the gel that had been run on the previous page 41. Constantly worrying about this resynthesis. Wednesday, August 9th, a reversible synthesis. Some idea that it might be done by reversing the direction of migration of the protein. The result on page 47 shows evidence of incomplete splitting yet. Retemperature, acetone synthesis, and so on. Keeping struggling with it. Repeat of resynthesis samples, page 55. Repeats of the same sort of thing. Page 61, Saturday, August 12th, repeat runs on everything, repeated again. And not at all frightened of repeating things, but not always getting anything out of it. And for example, on page 63, said, if promising, repeat with 1-1 and 2-2 on Tuesday. Another very promising statement, quite common, page 65, very promising with mercaptan ethanol, therefore repeat the whole procedure, etc., etc. Doesn't look very promising from where I'm looking now. August 15, some acetone freeze-dry repeats. Which are being looked at on page 73 with the comment, these dilute solution resyntheses are much superior. From what I know was the answer. I'm quite doubtful about that interpretation. The gels look as if nothing had ever happened and not that there was a resynthesis. But now here is a big change. Occurs between page 73 and 75. 73 was Saturday, August 19th, and page 75 is Sunday, Sunday, October 8th. And what happened in between was that George Connell, Gordon Dixon, and I went to a meeting in Rome, of the Human Genetics Society, and we had by this time reached the conclusion that haptoglobin 2 was bigger than haptoglobin, that HP2 was bigger than HP1. I don't remember where that conclusion was reached, but by then we had reached that conclusion. And Gordon Dixon and George Connell were in Toronto, and I was in Wisconsin. And we agreed that a critical test would be to using purified HP1, little HP1, little HP2, we would test the molecular size of the HP2 by running an ultracentrifuge experiment, which George would do. He was in Toronto and he could do that experiment nicely. And then we would meet the evening before our talk in Rome, and discuss how we were going to present the material, the general idea being that George would talk first about the purification and quantification of haptoglobin, and then on the separation into different chains, the constant chain and the variable HB1, little HB2 subunits. And Gordon would talk about the fingerprint tests, which led us to a conclusion that HB2 was bigger. And we would present them in that order, and then I would follow by talking about our hypothesis, which by then had been formed. So I'm going to pause here and go back a little while, because I haven't given the history here of how we got to the hypothesis. This happened as a result of my getting ready for a talk I was going to give in Japan, and looking very carefully at Gordon. At Gordon Dixon's fingerprints, I could see there were some rather strange relationships in there, that there were two peptides which were present in HP1 fingerprints and in HP2 fingerprints that appeared to be less common in less amount of them relative to the total amount of protein. Less amount of these two peptides in HP2 than there was in HP1. And there was an additional peptide in HP2 which was not present in HP1. And that peptide had amino acids that looked to be similar in composition to the two peptides which were in reduced amount. And it looked as if the extra peptide in HB2 was a junction between the two peptides that were in reduced amount, and we later called it the junction peptide. It looked also, we could see that the characteristic peptides that defined HP1F versus HP1S, that those two peptides were both present in the HP2 sample. So it looked as if HP2 had was a combined HP1F and HP1S, and this was very difficult to understand. And I visited Toronto at some time in that period, and I remember extremely well what happened, because in talking about these results, I suddenly said, well, let's see what happens if we believe our results, because we couldn't believe this. And then suddenly it became clear that HP2 was a junction between HP1F and HP1S, and the junction wasn't quite perfect. So the junction peptide was not the N-terminal and C-terminal exactly, the sum of those two, and that, etc., etc. So we had a good hypothesis already by the time we were getting ready for the meeting in Rome. Well, we got together that evening in Rome, and George Connell had a very, very long face, and he said, I've done the ultrasensitivity test, and the sedimentation coefficient of HP1, little HP1 versus little HP2, the sedimentation coefficients are the same, and so our hypothesis is wrong. I said, well, George, I don't agree with you. I think what we should do is we should do exactly what we said. We'll get up there and you can present your material and Gordon will present his, and I will present our hypothesis. And then I'll say, and we've tested this hypothesis by doing an ultracentrifuge run, and the ultracentrifuge says that the hypothesis is wrong. But I'll say that no, I think the ultracentrifuge is wrong and the hypothesis is correct. And I'll go back to Wisconsin and invent a new method of determining molecular size. And I knew by then that starch concentration affected large molecules more than it affected small molecules. So on page 75 of this notebook, there is a Sunday experiment, October 8th, HB, little HB1F, little HB1S, and little HB2 mobilities versus starch concentration. And I'm running a mixture of these three preparations in starch varying from 100% starch up to, in steps, to 145% starch. And the prediction is that I hope to see that 1F and 1S don't, the separation of 1F and 1S is not affected by starch concentration, they, whereas the large HP2 should be slowed down relative to, and there is the prediction on Sunday, October 8th, on page 75, and on page 77 and 76 of the graph, and the statement is made, the results are as predicted, exclamation mark. So this was the first real definite proof that HP2 was bigger than HP1F and 1S. It was a very beautiful and very exciting result, and was subject to a lot of cheering. Then continuing in a more mundane manner thereafter, some tests to get other data on the molecular weight determination. For example, October 11th, page 85, repeat the haptoglobin in quotation mark molecular weight determinations. And then beginning to realize that this was a general method for determining molecular size and might be useful for other things than just for haptoglobin. And so on page 89, there is a beginning of testing the effect of starch concentration on molecules of different sizes, lysozyme, insulin, alpha-chymotrypsinogen, or alpha-chymo, I don't remember whether it was trypsinogen or not. Yes, alpha-chymotrypsinogen and beta-lactoglobulin. And this led eventually to a paper which I published rather unwisely in a symposium remembrance of, or in recognition, yeah, I think he was still alive, in recognition of Tiselius's work with electrophoresis. And I'll stop there for a moment to find that reference. This was the beginning on page 91 of experiments attempting to use this idea of starch concentration to determine molecular size, which led to a publication which we shall no doubt come to the gels that were in the publication. This was what was going on in that period. For example, page 97, wide range test of 70 to 140% starch, gels, etc. with alpha camptrixins and insulin lysozyme so on, and being tested. 8-molar urea formic acid gel, which of course is a good gel, different concentrations, and so on. Some data on page 107, trying to get there to something worthwhile. Continuing with getting this method to work on the next several pages. Glucagon and ribonuclease survey on page 115 with a letter from William Bromer sending us some pork glucagon. People are always very willing to share. This was from the Eli Lilly and Company in Indianapolis, William Bromer, sending us glucagon from the molecular weight studies. Data getting a little better. Page 118. Page 125, quite a nice set of gels, where the data is where the concentration is varied with three proteins. Insulin, glucagon, and trypsin, as plotted on page 126. Going back to the subtyping of the haptoglobins on Friday, November 3rd, page 129, some further thoughts on this procedure. Reasonably happy with the results, but some complications. Page 137, small molecule molecular weight additives. Thinking about adding glucose or glycerol instead of just varying the starch concentration. And the glycerol migrations were plotted on page 139. Never led to anything. Continuing in the work and on page 149, Tuesday, November 21st, new longer 8-gel apparatus was used to make 8 gels as usual. There is a insulin B chain and HB1F alpha and HB1S alpha and HB2 alpha and HB beta gel. It's a really very pretty gel on that page. So the method was really working well. And we end this book with that as the, as it were, the final gel for this particular book. It's a beautiful set of gels on page 148, and they even now make my mouth water.